back to last week's Sedra, because I really feel that what has to be said on that Sedra is perhaps even more relevant than I want to say about next week's Sedra, and if need be, we'll save next week's Sedra for next year. The Sedra last week was Sedra of Shlach, which had in it the sin of the spies, who were sent by Moshe Rabbeinu to gather information about Eretz Yisrael, and they came back with a bad report and scared the people into not wanting to come and settle in Eretz Yisrael and conquer the land, and they remained in the Midbar for 40 years because of that and died out. It's interesting that the women were not part of that sin, only the men, and the many women, only the men died who were between 20 and 60 when they left Egypt. The women did not. Many widows entered Eretz Yisrael from that generation. In any case, the Haftorah speaks about the spies that Yehoshua sends. Min Hashitim sends two spies to go and see Jericho and the rest of the land. Now, the obvious connection between the Sedra and the Haftorah is the sending of spies. Moshe sent spies, Yehoshua sent spies. But there are tremendous differences between the spies that Moshe sent and the spies that Yehoshua sent. And I'm going to list a few of them. And when we discover the difference between them and the reason for these differences, we'll understand really what the sin of the spies was. First, the spies of Moshe Rabbeinu are sent by him and the entire nation together. And when they come back, they report to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they also report to the people directly. However, these spies that are sent by Yehoshua are sent meraglim cheresh. Cheresh, according to the Radak, means they were sent secretly, quietly. A cheresh is a deaf mute. They were sent without the knowledge of the Jewish people. So only Yehoshua sent them, no one else. And when they came back, they reported only to Yehoshua and not to the rest of the people. That's one difference. Another difference. Moshe Rabbeinu sent 12 spies, one from each tribe, each one their name being specifically mentioned, and one tribe sent no spies. Which tribe was that? Levi. Yehoshua sends two spies who are not named at all in the Navi. Their names are not mentioned. And we know that one of them was Kalev, and the other one was Pinchas. And Pinchas was from which tribe? Levi. So Moshe sends 12 and none from Levi. Yehoshua only sends two, and one of them is from Levi. Moshe sends spies that are the heads of each tribe, and their names are mentioned, and Yehoshua sends two spies, names not mentioned at all. Okay. Another thing that we're going to have to discuss is, if after Moshe sending the spies was such a miserable tragedy and failure, why did Yehoshua send spies? Didn't he learn a lesson from what Moshe Rabbeinu did? In order to answer all of this, I want to explain the following. If you want a more of a detailed explanation of what I'm going to say now, you can look in my Sefer, Outlooks and Insights, on last week's Sedra. And there it has a lengthy understanding of what I'm going to now condense into a few sentences. And that's the following. What was the basis of the sin of the spies? The basis basically was the following. The Jewish people knew that when they came to Eretz Yisrael, they would no longer be guided by God's divine providence of open miracles, as they were in the desert. In the desert, everything was done with open miracles. If they had to eat, bread rained down from the heavens, man. If they had to drink, there was a miraculous spring that traveled along with them and provided water for millions of people. if they sinned, immediately the punishment came, and so on and so on. There was a cloud of glory that went with them in the daytime, and a pillar of fire at night, miracle after miracle after miracle. In any case, they knew that Hanhoga, that divine providence, would stop cow and fertilize and harvest, but their food supply would depend on their keeping the mitzvahs or not, and it would be obvious that was the case. If they kept the mitzvahs, it would rain, and there would be food. If they didn't keep the mitzvahs, then it wouldn't rain, and there wouldn't be food, as it says in the Shema. And they would know, they would see the relationship, hidden miracles. The weatherman would get on the radio, and he would say, we have made a investigation, and most of the Jews are keeping the mitzvahs, there's going to be rain tomorrow. He wouldn't say there's a high-level system here and a low-pressure system here, and therefore we predict rain. It would be tied directly to their keeping mitzvahs, which is a miracle, but it's a miracle that happens in a natural way. And the Jewish people were under the impression that if things happen naturally, then they have to make them happen. They're the ones who are the causes. And that was a terrible mistake. Even when God deals with us, nature doesn't mean that we are the cause. God is cause. And that applies not only when miracles happen in a natural way, but even when there are no miracles, even hidden ones in nature, like we live today, where everything is hidden, where God's face is completely hefted upon him, completely hidden. We don't see any relationship between mitzvahs and rainfall. We don't see God's hand in the events of history too much. We see political, social, economic causes that seem to be causing things in the world. The truth is, though, as the Vilna Gaon says, that in any way that we perceive God's divine providence is only how we perceive it. But ultimately, it's God who's in charge. From God's side, nothing is different between when God does open miracles and when his face is hidden and it appears like everything's haphazard. Bottom line, God is controlling the world. How it appears to us is the only difference. So even when things have to happen by nature, it's not that we're in control. God is still in control. God makes it appear natural, and he gives us a prerequisite that we have to be involved and put in natural effort. And therefore, the concept that a person earns his living, makes a living, I'm going to make a living, is a fallacy. We don't make our living. Just as much as we don't make ourselves live, God makes us live. But we have a responsibility to do what is natural. That's only a prerequisite. We have to go through the motions. Ultimately, if we earn a living or not is up to God. God is the one who provides a living. And the truth is, if you think about it, no matter what a person does, right, he can't guarantee anything. So unless he has God's help, whether he's going to make a living or not, right, is not something that he can guarantee or he can cause. There are many people who do all the right things. They got all the right degrees, and they are qualified, and they are picking in garbage cans to eat because they're overqualified, because what they trained for no longer is necessary. And there are people who make all the wrong things, and they're sometimes millionaires, right? Russians who came over here who were doctors, engineers, are cleaning offices, right? Nothing wrong with that. But all their training went to waste. They don't have to be engineers and doctors to be people of cleaning companies. But they're overqualified. There's no need for their expertise over here to a certain degree. And the opposite is also true. The example I love to give is, in America about 20, 30 years ago, there was a phenomenon called pet rocks. What happened was somebody woke up one morning and had this great idea. He is going to take plain, ordinary rocks, put them in a box with a sheet of instructions how to care for this rock as a pet. And he will sell this for $9.99, okay, commercially. Okay, now if anybody would have been asked, do you think this is a marketable idea? The answer would have been, you got to be out of your mind. No one in their right mind is going to spend $10 for a rock in a cardboard box with a sheet of paper, right, that tells you how to walk your rock, right, what not to feed your rock, what the name that you can give, the pedigree of the rock, right, no one is going to spend $10 for a pet rock when they can go outside and get a whole zoo full of them for free. No, but go and understand Americans. I gave it to the English last time. Tonight we'll give it to the Americans. They are the craziest people in the world. And people bought this by the millions. The man became a millionaire overnight from selling pet rocks. Does it make any sense? No. But God, for some reason, wanted this guy to be a millionaire, and he made him a millionaire. Gave him a crazy idea, gave enough other crazy people who were even crazier to pick up on the idea, and that's it. Right? Cabbage patch dolls. Right? They had dolls that a mother couldn't love. What? Okay, yeah. Fresh Air, right, from Florida. They used to sell in Miami. Empty cans with Floridian air in it. You couldn't even open it because if you opened it, the air escaped. Right? Okay. So there are enough crazy people in the world for God to work in unnatural ways to make people rich. So it's not the person who is causing his parnasa. He is just fulfilling a condition. Ultimately, whether he will have a parnasa or not is in the hands of God. With that, I once wanted to explain, yeah. What? No, God has his cheshbonus, why he would want to give a person parnasa. That's his reasons. The person has to put in, if he doesn't put in his effort and doesn't fulfill the prerequisite, he won't get a parnasa b'chlal. But he has to put some prerequisite in. Okay. Now, I always like to explain with that something that always bothered me. Today we have young men that plan on sitting and learning Torah and not going to work. And usually the wives work. Right, or they have somebody help support them, parents, in-laws, whatever. But they are definitely not going out to work. So there's no problem with that. Any person is allowed to dedicate himself to Torah, and if somebody wants to support him, that's a mitzvah and a schus. And if he, what's it called, has a wife who's willing to work and sacrifice that, it's very nice from her standpoint. No problem with that. That's not the problem. Problem is, if you ever listen to a ksuba, a marriage contract being read, it's in Aramaic, so you probably didn't understand a word of it. But part of it says the following. The chosam, the groom, makes the following declaration. Va'ano eflach va'okir va'ezom va'afarnes yisechi lechi. Which means the following. I will work and honor you and support you and feed you as befits a Jewish husband. Now, a person who knows that he's going into the marriage and he's going to be sitting in the base medrash and learning, right? How can you say that? It's like a lie. So why don't we have a different ksuba for people who are sitting and learning that leaves out that sentence? Or says, and you will support and whatever, go to work and support me. What? Okay. We're not talking about what should be, but that's the fact, right? Why is that the case? So I was thinking, the truth is that even a person who goes to work is only fulfilling a prerequisite, a condition. He's not causing his parnasa by his work, like we said. He's fulfilling a condition. Now the Gemara says everybody has to work. That's a precondition in this world, you have to work. But people can put their effort and their work into different things. Tavi, dezachi, deriftiki, deraisa. Fortunate is the person who can channel his efforts and his work directly into Torah. Therefore, does it really make a difference if a person gets up at 8 o'clock in the morning, gets to an office at 9, works till 5, and picks up a check at the end of the month? Or if he goes to a Beis Medrash in the morning, puts in a tremendous amount of mental work and labor, and picks up a check at the end of the month, because somebody's supporting him or his wife is working or whatever. Again, it's only a prerequisite. and you can put your effort, not necessarily directly in what you think is the cause and what the effect will be. It's not a cause and effect. So this man is working. He's working in a base medrash, and he's putting in tremendous effort. If he's not, then he's not doing what's proper. And he's saying, I will work, and I will provide for you, and he is. Right? Happens to be that the way that it comes through is another way. The effect comes in a different way than the cause, but it always does. It's never a cause and effect relationship. That you have to put in your effort, and then the result comes. Yeah. First of all, that's a Mishnah in Kedushin, not a Gemara. Second of all, there is another opinion in that Mishnah, in that same Mishnah that you are quoting. The Mishnah says like this: Rabbi Meir Omer, right? Chayiv Adam Lelamed Es Beno Umnis Nekiya Vekala. A man is required to teach his son an easy and clean trade. He's also required to teach him Torah. That's what you quoted. Then there's another part to the Mishnah. The Mishnah ends the following way: Rabbi Nehu Roy Omer. Rabbi Nehu Roy says, Meiniach ani kol umnis sheba'olam, I will forego teaching my son any trade. Ve'eini melamed es b'ni al Torah, I will only teach my son Torah. And then it goes to extol the virtues of learning Torah. The Mefarshim, the Brisker Rav and others explain, there's no argument over here. Klal Yisrael has a majority of people who must work in a normal, earthly occupation and earn a living and also learn Torah. Okay? They're not exempt from learning Torah. But they are not people who are dedicated totally to Torah. They're people who combine an earthly occupation, a worldly occupation with Torah. Then Klal Yisrael needs individuals, a minority of people, right? They were never a majority. It's always a minority of Jews world over who are totally dedicated to Torah. They are like the tribe of Levi. The Kohanim and Leviim did nothing else except learn, teach, take care of the Beis HaMikdash, and do spiritual things. They didn't get a portion in Eretz Yisrael. They didn't earn a living. They were supported by the community. The other 12 tribes, right, each one had their personal occupation, and they also learned Torah, right? They combined the two. So too, throughout history, the Jewish people need individuals who will be devoted totally to Torah, to be the leaders of the Jewish people, and the people who will provide the spiritual wherewithal for the Jewish people to exist. And then we need also people who are earning a living and combining Torah with, that's the way the Jewish people are. So you need both of them. Okay. Okay, now, yeah. I assume these are all theoretical questions. As theoretical questions, I'll answer them. If they were actual questions, I wouldn't answer until I heard all of the details. I'm going to give you a general rule, okay? The general rule is the following. How much ishtadlus do you need? As much as you think you need. God, why do you have to put in your effort in order that it appears to be natural and not miraculous? God doesn't want to do miracles for us that would force us to believe. So he wants us to do things that appear natural. In order to appear natural, we have to put in our effort. Okay? And that way we have the chance of thinking that we are causing this naturally, and we have a mitzvah then to believe that that's not the case, that it's still God behind it. That's how we merit in this world, by doing things in a way that we could make the mistake to think that we're the cause and to believe that's not the case. Okay? But if we would do it in a way that would be miraculous, God doesn't do miracles for us. Therefore, whatever you think will bring your parnasa naturally, that's how much you have to do. And it's not enough to say, well, I think that if I only have one job, then I'll be able to make my parnasa, and inside your kishkas are eating yourself alive, that you're worried what's going to be tomorrow because there's no way naturally you're going to be able to do this. So a person who really believes, and we're talking about really believes, not says it, that what he's doing will definitely bring him, or can definitely bring him a parnasa, and he doesn't need to do anything more, and he really believes that, won't have to do any more. If he doesn't really believe it, and if he made a parnasa based on the hashtaglis he's doing, he would think it's a miracle, then he's going to have to do more hashtaglis. So it really depends on what is real by that person. I'll give you an example. Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, okay, one day something happened. I don't want to go into the whole details because we're getting off the topic, and I really want to finish this. And we didn't start it yet. The question is a good question, and it deserves an answer. One day he decided that he no longer can really have the bitachon, the tremendous trust that he had of not having to work, be a rabbi, and somehow his parnasa would come, and he was satisfied, and his wife and children with almost nothing, that he would have to go and make an effort and do his shtablis. So what did he do? Went out of the house, put on his coat. Somebody followed him to see what's he going to do. Is he going to go hire himself out to be a porter? What is he going to do? Where's his shtablis? He went to the walls of the old city, kicked around in the sand a little bit, bent down, picked up a gold coin. That was enough for the next month. That was his shtablis. Now, if I did that, okay, I wouldn't stop talking about it for the next 10 years of what miracle happened to me. He didn't consider it a miracle. He didn't consider it any more of a miracle. It's natural that people lose coins by the walls of the city, right? And if I put in my effort and kick around the sand a little bit, if God wants to provide me a parnasa, he'll make me find a gold coin. There's nothing miraculous about that. But if I did that, I would consider it a miracle. I wouldn't consider that hishtadlis that would cause me to have a parnasa. So for me, I need to do more than that. For him, he didn't, because he really believed that's all he had to do was put in a prerequisite. He put in his prerequisite, and he got the results. Okay, so it depends on what you really believe, first thing. Second thing, if somebody comes in your house and steals, should you pursue them? Yes, because they did something wrong. And you have a right, not only have a right, but you have a responsibility to see that things that are wrong in this world don't happen. And therefore, if somebody undercuts you in a way that's prohibited, opens up competition that's prohibited, then you should do something about it, because you are stopping avla, something that is injustice in the world. And even though you have a claim and a vested interest, that doesn't make it not good to stop somebody from harming you in a way they have no right to harm you. You have a right to demand justice. On the other hand, if somebody opens up a business where they have a right to open up, there's no prohibition, right, but you think it's going to hurt your business. Or if somebody breaks a contract in a way that they have a right to break the contract, it's legal, halachically, okay, then you should say, this is God's way of telling me that whatever it is I don't need, or I shouldn't get, or I better do tshuva, or whatever, that I'm getting some kind of hint, because that person didn't know anything wrong, and therefore I have no right to oppose them, and I should have bitachon that the Rebbeinu Shlomo will see to it that I make my parnasa, and that person's not doing anything wrong, he's doing whatever's halachic. If it's non-halachic, then you should stand up to it, fight it, because we all have a responsibility to see that injustice isn't done in the world, and that's an injustice. And it doesn't make a difference if the injustice being done to you or to somebody else. Okay? Okay. Let's go on. Okay, in any case, what? Where was what? If I find out, I will not tell you. Okay, in any case, so this basically is the sin that can be described as stealing kochivotzim yodi. It's my might, my power. Whereas the Meiri says, what's kochivotzim yodi? It's usually translated my might and my power. Otzim, right? Otzma. Meiri says means something else. Kochi means I earn my money with my might. And then I hold on to it. Otzim yodi. I close my hand on it. Don't give it to anybody else. So hold on to it. Right? That's how I preserve my financial position. So in that situation, a person basically asserts and promotes himself too much. He thinks too much of himself, that he's a cause, he's a player in this world, and he doesn't realize that God is really the player and the cause. And he looks too much at external causes and attributes to those external causes the effects, and not the fact that there's something spiritual behind all this that's making the effect more than the external causes. And the truth is that when it comes to a person, what he can cause, what's in his hands in this world, is only spiritual things. And everything else is in God's hands. Hakol bidei shamayim, everything's in God's hands, chutz miyiras shamayim. You can control your spiritual level, and that will make a difference. But you can't control the physical things. So when a person says, well, it's my prowess, my business acumen, it's my might, my whatever it is, he's fooling himself. Because that's things you don't control. It's your tzidkus, whether you're Yirei Shamayim, how much Yirei Shamayim, that you can control. You can't control anything else. And therefore, the Hashem Yishmuel explains the Medrash. The Medrash says that the Meraglim of Yoshua, Masru Nafsham, right, they gave over their lives, really, in order to be matzliach, to succeed. They gave themselves over, and that's why they were successful. Meaning the following, that they negated themselves. We're not the ones who are causing anything. We're just putting in the effort, the prerequisite. God will see to it that it works out. That's what it means they gave themselves up. In fact, the Sfasema says, that's why Meraglim Cheresh, the Medrash comments, don't read Cheresh, but Cheres. They were like earthenware. What's it mean, earthenware? So some say they disguise themselves as people selling earthenware pots. Nobody would suspect that they were spies because they were involved in such a lowly kind of thing. But the Sfas Emes says the following. He says that earthenware only contracts spiritual impurity, tumma, from the inside. On the out, if you touch on the outside, it doesn't. Unlike metal and wood, but if you touch on the outside, it becomes spiritually impure. And what's explained usually is that something, in order to become spiritually impure, has to have a worth, has to have a value. Metal, wood, has a value in the material and in its function. So if you touch the inside, you're touching the function. If you touch the outside, you're touching the material. In either case, it becomes impure. But kli cheres, earthenware, has no intrinsic value. Its value is its use, is its function. So if you touch it on the outside, you're touching the material. It doesn't contract tumma. If you touch it on the inside, you're touching the function, then it contracts tumma. So these meraglim didn't feel themselves important. It was their mission that was important. They weren't important, and therefore they're not named. The Meraglim of Yoshua are nameless. And therefore, they went quietly. It wasn't something that was a lot of fanfare. On the other hand, the Meraglim of Yoshua considered themselves important. We're the cause. We're going to go and see what Eretz Yisrael, and we're going to see to it that we conquer Eretz Yisrael. Not that we're going to put in the effort and God is going to conquer it for us. We're going to make the difference. We'll see one second what the difference is between them. In any case, it says, therefore, that the Meraglim of Yoshua were sent quietly, modestly, b'tznius. And the Michtam Eliyahu says an interesting thing, that when a person is involved in earning a living or in doing anything else to cause his physical betterment, he should do it modestly and with a feeling almost of guilt that I'm doing something that appears that I don't believe that God is the one who's taking care. that I think I'm doing it myself, even though I know that I'm not doing it like that, and I'm doing it only because God said I have to do this, and it's a prerequisite, and I'm not the cause. So in order, but still it looks not like that. So therefore, a person, when he does involve himself in these things, should do it modestly, quietly, not with a lot of fanfare, with a feeling of tremendous humility. So therefore, the spies of Yeshua went with humility, quietly, modestly, whereas the spies of Moshe were asserting themselves, promoting themselves. So they went with their names, and they went. Now, the difference between, what's the purpose of the spies? Hold on. What are the purpose of the spies? Purpose of the spies was completely different between what Yeshua sent and what Moshe sent. Moshe sent the spies, and he did this. I don't want to go into now why Moshe agreed to send them, if it was all the wrong intention. Again, look in my book, you'll see why Moshe sent them. Okay? But the spies of Moshe went with the attitude, we're going to have to cause this conquering of the land. And they therefore went to get how they would perceive what's going on, their perception. So therefore, Moshe had to send 12 spies, one from each tribe, because each tribe saw things differently. And he needed them to come back and make their assessment and their perception. They were involved very much actively. Okay? And therefore, they were the heads of the tribes, each one making their assessment. And for that respect, Levi was no purpose of sending Levi. Levi had no physical cause in the Jewish people. He wasn't the one who went to war, and he wasn't the one who did anything physical, material, so why send Levi? So Levi and weren't sent. On the other hand, Yeshua, according to the Ralbag, why did he send spies? Not that they should go and assess the situation and come back and tell what their assessment was in order to give a plan how to conquer the land. But they went, Meraglin Cheresh, the Ralbag says, means they went to listen, not to talk. They went to hear how the nations of the world reacted to the fact that the Jewish people were coming, knowing that their reaction was of such a nature that if they would come back and report it, it would strengthen the hearts of the people who had to go into battle. Because they would hear that the people in Canaan, who they have to fight, have lost their morale because they're afraid of us. And they had to hear it firsthand, because it makes a bigger difference if you hear it firsthand than you just know it. So they went to hear it firsthand. And therefore, Meraglim Cheresh means, the word Cheresh can also mean to think, to plan. They went to hear the thoughts and the plans of the nations of the world who they were going to have to fight. And the Radak says the same thing. The purpose of Yeshua's sending the spies was not to get an assessment of the situation, how they could conquer the land. All of that was already a given. Yeshua already made all of the arrangements to cross over the Jordan and to start conquering the land before he sent the spies. He wasn't waiting for the spies to come back to find out, should we go or shouldn't we go, and how should we go. No. The only thing he wanted from the spies is come back and give us some positive reinforcement, give us a little encouragement to be able to conquer the land and do what we're supposed to do properly. We don't need your assessment, and therefore they didn't need 12 people. All they had to do was go and report what they heard. How many people do you need to report, to believe a report? Two witnesses. That's all. Apishnayim Aden. He sent two witnesses. And he sent Kalev, who was successful in the first mission and went with the right intention, as opposed to the other 10, aside from Yeshua. And he sent Pinchas, the Kohen, who was the Mashuach Milchama. He's the one who went into battle with them to encourage them, to speak to them, give them a pep talk, a spiritual pep talk, before the battle. So those were the two that were necessary. The people he knew would hear, come back, and report accurately what they heard, not interested in making assessments, not interested in telling us how to do it. God will take care of it. We have to do our hishtaglus, and for that we need to be encouraged. So we need somebody to come back and give us a pep talk. So the Kohen was the one to do that, and Kalev ben Yefuneh, who gave him a pep talk the first time around. And therefore, therefore, when they came back, they only reported to Yeshua. They didn't report to the people. People didn't have to hear from them directly. Yeshua had to hear what the people were saying, and Yeshua reported to the people just to give them a certain amount of encouragement, a certain amount of pep talk. And therefore, the spies of Moshe, when you think that you're the cause, and physical things cause things in this world, then if you see somebody who's stronger than you, has more things going for him physically, you're afraid of him. Because what you think causes things with you, he has more of the same. So when they saw the giants, they were afraid of them. And they didn't look at the spiritual causes, and therefore they were afraid. Masha'in Cain, Yoshua's Meraglim, said, we heard that the nations of the world, they were the same giants. They saw the same things. But the people were afraid. They looked inside. The people had lost all morale, all courage. They melted away. Since when? Not recently, when they heard of the battles that Moshe won against Sihon and Og. But from the time of the splitting of the Red Sea, Rachab said, we already lost all our courage. Had the spies of Moshe gone and looked beyond the facade of the giant, looked in what's in their heart, they would have seen these giants have melted hearts. They're also afraid since God split the Red Sea. But they didn't look beyond the physical. They saw the physical as the cause. They didn't see spiritual things as being important. Whereas Yoshua's spies came back, and they, what's it called, the spies of Moshe, therefore also took in the externals of Eretz Yisrael. It's a beautiful land, externally. But externally, it's a land that's impossible to conquer. They didn't look to see the spiritual values, which all of those physical things, the negatives, weren't negatives anymore. And therefore, it's interesting, the Meraglim of Yeshua come back, and they say the following. God has already given us the whole land, given it into our hand. And not only that, but all of the inhabitants of the land have melted before us. Their hearts have melted before us. The order is the opposite. Should have said, because the hearts of the people who are going to have to stand against us have melted, therefore God will give us the land. That's the way it's going to happen. But they realize that God doesn't need ways for it. He just has to make it look natural. So the fact is, given. God already gave it to us. Why didn't he give it to us? It's already a fait accompli. How is it going to work and look natural? Because the people are already afraid of us. So God has already worked out how he's going to make it look natural. But the fact is that God gave us the land. The fact that the people's hearts melted, that's only the effect. It's not the cause. And therefore, it's said as an effect. The cause is that God gave us the land. That's what Yoshua's spy said. And therefore, they came back and they told Yoshua, Vayisapulo eskol hamotzos osam, everything that found them. They didn't consider whatever they did, that they caused it. That it all was sent by God, and it happened to them. They realized whatever happens in this world, we're not the ones who make it happen. We're the ones who have to react to it in a proper way. That's a person's job in this world, to take the things that find him and react to them properly spiritually. But that we create causes, we create the situations, that's not the case. And therefore they came and explained what found them, not what they did, but what found them and how they have to react to it. And therefore the Sedra, the Haftorah, is not just a connection, the spies and spies, but the differences between the spies of Yoshua and the spies of Moshe, the contrast, teaches us to understand what the problem was with the spies of Moshe. And how Yehoshua, who sent spies, didn't repeat the same mistake, but sent them the way that they should have been sent the first time, with the right intention. And then they would have been successful. And by seeing how Yehoshua did it properly, we understand what the sin was of the ones who went improperly. And again, why Moshe agreed to send them is a separate issue. Look in the Sefer. Yes? No, he told him, Shlach Lecha. And Rashi says, Shlach Lecha means you send them, meaning, I'm not commanding you to send them. If you want to, then you can send them. I'm not telling you you can't.
Well, let me try.
Yeah, what's it called? But again, if you look in the book, you'll see there was a reason why the Rabbanu Shlom couldn't command Moshe Rabbeinu to do it. Not because he yelled it was bad, because when he yelled it was bad, why would Moshe send them? But because, again, they made the mistake to think that if it's going to happen naturally, we have to make it happen. And therefore, they had to get an assessment of the situation and know how to ready themselves and prepare themselves for the conquering of the... That was their mistake. In order to do that, okay, they needed to send 12 people or whatever. In order to do that, they had to send the spies the way that they thought was necessary, and they couldn't be commanded by God. It had to be done naturally. So Moshe had to do it for them. The reason that Moshe and God did this is to let them know that they made a mistake. So he went along with their mistake and send it the way that you think you need, but hopefully when you'll get there, you'll come to the conclusions you made a mistake. Meaning the following. Let me just paint it, the picture. What was their mistake? If it's going to happen naturally, and God has said it's going to happen naturally, then we have to make it happen. So now they're going to go to the land, they're going to see the following. God said it's going to happen naturally, one given. Second given, God said we're going to conquer this land, second given. Third, we can't do it naturally. It's impossible. Now, those three facts contradict each other. If it's going to happen naturally, and we can't do it naturally, then how's it going to happen? Something's wrong. 1 second, something's wrong. But God tied his hands, and he said it's going to happen naturally. So even God can't help us. Because God's will is it's going to happen naturally, and naturally means we cause it, and we can't cause it. That was their wrong conclusion. What should have been the right conclusion? The right conclusion should have been, till now we thought it's going to happen naturally, which is true. And God has tied his hands and make it happen. It's going to happen only naturally. One thing. We see that we can't make it happen naturally. Yet God said it's going to happen. How could that be? Answer, we're not the ones who are going to cause it. God's going to cause it, and he's going to make it look naturally after we put in our effort. That's all. No problem. We made a mistake. Naturally doesn't mean that we cause it. Naturally means that God makes it look natural. But they didn't reach that conclusion. They came with the same set of facts, and they came to the wrong conclusion. If we can't do it, then it can't happen, since it has to happen naturally. And that's why they said, Ki chazaku mimenu, the goyim are stronger than God. Now, were they stupid? Did they really think that these people with spears were stronger than God? That was their infantile understanding of God? These are great people. How could they say such a thing? The answer is simple. Because God himself said, it's going to have to happen naturally. That's God's will. So God has tied his hands and obligated himself that this is going to happen naturally. And therefore, according to their understanding of naturally, that means that he's taken it out of his control, put it into ours. And therefore, even God himself can't help us because he has tied his hands. His will is that it's going to have to depend on us. They should have come to a conclusion that that's not true. Since God promised it's going to happen, he also said it's going to happen naturally. We can't do it naturally. Must be that we're not the ones who are going to do it. But God will do it, and he'll do it in a natural way. That should have been their conclusion. But they didn't give in. They stuck to their mistake that if it's natural, we're going to have to do it. And therefore, they came to the conclusion it can't be done. That was a mistake. Where does it say that? The Mepharshim learned that within the Ramban or whatever, when Moshe after the Chet HaEgel, God says, I'm sending an angel with you. And I'm not going to go with you anymore directly. And the Mepharshim explained that angel is the angel of nature. Meaning that God said, you are not on the level anymore for me to deal with you directly. It's too dangerous. So I'm going to deal with you indirectly through nature. Moshe said, if you don't go with directly, don't bother. I will not accept an angel. And God acquiesced, and for 40 years in the desert, it was all supernatural. When did the angel finally come? By Yeshua. It says when Yeshua was in Ai, an angel came, who was dressed like the like a general, and he said, now I came. Now's the time where God is no longer being involved directly, but he's doing it through angels, angels meaning powers of nature. That's for the whole time in Eretz Yisrael, until we went into Golus, and then it's even less than that. It's Hester Pem, and it's God's face is hidden. Okay, yeah. Right. Right, there's, okay, the truth is, let me say something for next week's Sedra, from the Drush I would have told you if I had time, is about the king, because that's the Haftarah of next week's Sedra, when they ask for a king. The Kli Yoker says a very interesting thing. The Torah says, if you come and ask for a king, Shem Tassim Alech HaMelech, for the king, it's a mitzvah. When the people ask for a king, Shmuel gets all upset and gives them Musar, why'd you ask for a king? So the Kli Yoker says there's many answers. For one answer, he says the following. The way they asked for a king is not the way the Torah described asking for a king. When the Torah said, asked for a king, the king was, let us put over us a king. We want to submit ourselves to a king who will lead us according to what's right, not what we want. When they asked for a king in the time of Shmuel, they said, Tnu lanu melech, give us a king, not put a king over us. Put him in our hands, we'll manipulate, we'll use him for what we want. If you think that you're going to tell the leader what to do, right, then he's not a king anymore, and you're not, that's not good, right? That's the difference, says the Kli Yoker, yeah? Well, that's a long discussion. But he was never supposed to be a permanent king, he was supposed to be a temporary king until the Melucha was ready from Yehuda, and it wasn't ready yet at that point. So Binyamin was a precursor to Malchus Yehuda. It could be that the situation was with Malchus Bistavid wasn't ready yet. For a host of reasons, which are not our regular achas. Okay. Yes, Hashem, that we find some haftorah that we can get in Mach Chodesh next year.
July, August, and hopefully, if we lose them, we'll come back.